This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano is who I am, and I'm here every week talking about the disease of addiction, the road to recovery, and offering some, we think, success stories that might be helpful to people who are faced with the disease of addiction. The whole thing is sponsored by Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, about which more a lot later. From that organization, we've got Maggie Hunt, who joins us periodically. She is the director of their alumni group, and ever so often she arranges for us to talk to someone who's in successful recovery and a member of that alumni group. Hi, Maggie. Good to see you again.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Now, we've got an interesting guest today, somebody that you not only share this relationship with as the director of alumni and an alumni, but somebody that you matriculated with.
Yeah. We were actually in treatment together when we both were struggling at the same time. And then I met him at retreat when I was in a different role.
Before we identify this person and bring him on the air, let's take a moment and talk about, why we think, I want to hear it from you, why we think it's important to hear these stories. Because one of the things I like to say is that they may all sound the same, but they're different. What's the strength in hearing stories of people who are in sober living situations?
Yeah, well, I think that the biggest thing that you hear when you hear somebody's story is hope. And for some people, they might not see any hope. They might not know that there is another way to live. So by sharing the hope and continuing to talk about the hope, that's how it spreads. The best way to kind of prevent things happening is to continue to talk about it and continue to share in the good experiences.
So who do you have for us today?
Today I have David Lease for you today, and he is he's been like a peer of mine, and that still continues today.
So we welcome David Lease to Recovery Radio. Hello, David.
Hi, Steve. How are you? Thanks for having me.
I'm great. We begin at the beginning on the program, and that involves finding out who you are. So bring us up to speed. Who's David Lease?
Well, I pretty much, in a nutshell, grew up in the Philadelphia area. I was adopted, and for a while, that always caused like issues with me, and I grew up like right outside of Philadelphia in Delaware County, like Upper Darby. Went to all the public schools for a while, and then I don't know. I'm messing up right now.
No, you're not. You're doing fine. You've told this story a million times.
Just tell
it again. Let me back up a second here now, because you're the first person I've talked to who mentioned being adopted, and it caused what kind of problems? First of all, when were you aware you were adopted? Did your adoptive parents tell you were adopted?
Yeah, they were actually always really open about it. I was adopted at birth. As I got older, I would ask my mom questions, and I can remember early on, I'd ask my mom, did I grow in your tummy? And she said, no, you grew in my heart. And
you were very young when you were asking these questions?
Yes. Yeah. I used to always, kind of just question things, question life, just not ever feel like I belonged. I felt like I was a square peg in a round hole, basically, and I just fell out of place.
Yeah.
And, my mom pretty much told me, early on that my birth mother was very young. She was about 16. She was a runaway. She ran away from home at like 13 years old, and she was really into the Grateful Dead and followed them around the country, and she got pregnant at some point and, came home to have me, and, the adoption had been arranged. And
how old were you when you had that whole story?
I'm sorry, say that again.
How old were you when you had that whole story about your birth mother?
I think I got it in bits and pieces.
Okay.
I don't think that they told me all at once, but they always emphasized that she loved me and that she just wasn't in a position mm-hmm. where she was able to mm-hmm. Raise a child mm-hmm. at the time.
Did you were there other do you have siblings? Do you have adopted siblings?
Yes, I have a younger sister as well, 3 years younger, and she was adopted from a different family.
Oh, is that right? Oh. So I was going to ask you whether or not you felt at some point the outsider, but if there was another adopted child in the family, it probably normalized it in one sense. Although I will ask you this question, because we hear it time and time again. People with substance abuse problems often talk about not fitting in or feeling like an outsider. And did you feel any of that? And did you assign it to the fact that you were adopted, or did you just think you were different?
I mean, I think part of it, excuse me, I think part of it played into like the adoption, but I mean, I can't really pinpoint exactly why I just always felt less than, or always felt, you know, I can't exactly like pinpoint where all those feelings came from. I mean, I can say part of it has to do with that, and part of it could just be, you know, manifestations from, you know, my disease of addiction and alcoholism before I even picked up, be that uncomfortability.
Right. But you had those feelings, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. So tell me about, you say you were from the area. Where exactly were you raised, and what were the circumstances? You go to school, you have friends. What was school like for you?
Well, like I said, I lived in like the Delaware County area, moved around a little bit as a kid. For like elementary and middle school and all that, I was enrolled in Lower Marion, which is a little bit past, it's like on the border, it's like the main line, like Baltimore, Bryn Mawr. And
yep.
I can just say growing up, I had a lot of learning difficulties. I acted out. To the point where, like, they had to assign somebody, like, I guess you want to call her an aide or something, where, you know, I pretty much had to be followed around because, like, I would just act up and, like, I never seemed to be at peace, you know, and I had to be in, you know, like, resource room and, you know, like, remedial classes. And I think that played a big part into, like, my self-esteem because, like, I felt like I was less than. I saw all the other kids, you know, doing, you know, regular things, and like I got all these, you know, issues, and I think early on it kind of made me feel separate from everybody, and a part of it had to do with my actions, you know, keep separating myself. But, you know, at the time as a kid, I didn't realize that, and I just thought, well, like, oh, I must be broken or something, because, you know, like all the other kids, you know, seem like they're having a good time and they're not getting in trouble. And I'm always in the principal's office and getting kicked out of school. And, you know, from an early age, like those behaviors. And then, I mean, around like fourth or fifth grade, I started to like kind of even out a little bit. And I'll add as a side note, back in like the early 90s, like ADD, ADHD was like a new term. It really been coined around that time. So around 4 years old, I was put on Ritalin because my mom didn't know what to do with me. So she took me to a bunch of doctors, and, you know, they prescribed me Ritalin, Adderall, and then I'd be, you know, up all day, and I would crash and I wouldn't be able to sleep. So they prescribed like Clonidine to help me sleep. So I think at an early age, I was already, you know, used to, you know, handling my problems with medication. You know,
this is a whole area. We're not in a position to get into it here now, but there needs to be a lot more work done to see what the relationship is between medicating children like you when they did, for all the right reasons, and what, if any, relationship exists to your ultimate, because of that, and your ultimate problem with drugs. There are some people that ought not to have any kind of drugs because they have a tendency. Mac, you agree with any? Because they ultimately are going to have a tendency to abuse those drugs, and we have a whole culture set up that a fellow like David in the fourth grade was being given drugs.
Right.
So we need to know a lot more about what the relationship is. David, let me ask you about being a youngster, and I forget, how old are you in fourth grade? What is that?
Is that 8 or 9, maybe, because I know in fifth grade I turned 10.
And so they're giving you drugs at that age. Are you able to remember now you're almost 30, you're 20 years old. Are you able to remember what it felt like when they gave you Ritalin? What you personally?
I just remember being spaced out, and I remember like I used to like pick at my like my hair a lot, and like I remember one teacher, you know, it was taking me. I went to the bathroom, and I was in there for a while, and they sent like a male teacher, and he said I was just in the mirror, just like picking my hair out, like just picking at it, like, and I remember thinking that there was like. I just felt like there was stuff under my skin, like I can't explain it, like almost what you would hear somebody having amphetamine psychosis.
Yeah. But you clearly recall feeling one way, being given Ritalin, and then feeling another way.
Correct.
Right. And then, obviously, other drugs then to bring you down from the Ritalin. Take me through, all right, so you know, that's... It's got nothing to do with you. You weren't making those choices on your own. Adults were doing that for you. At what point do you start experimenting with drugs or alcohol? How old were you?
I guess around 12 or 13, I started to have like an interest in, you know, I think what actually piqued my interest was I read a book called Go Ask Alice, which was like the memoirs of a girl in the 70s who started abusing drugs, and I remember just how she almost like glamorized, like especially like smoking marijuana and, you know, drinking, how it made her feel good and warm. And I think I just at that point I was like, oh, that sounds interesting, like I'd like to try that one day, but I don't think I made the action quite yet. And then around 13, at this point, like I got in with, you know, some friends, and I was like, I was starting to like get out of my shell. But you know, it's like as soon as that happened, you know, I got involved with some friends that, you know, had older siblings that, you know, smoked weed. And I can remember, you know, meeting up with a buddy of mine after school and smoking for the first time. And like, I just felt like that void that I felt my whole life had been filled almost. I felt like that's how I want to feel for the rest of my life.
Yeah,
and I remember feeling, you know, if this is how good weed feels, like I want to see how all the other drugs feel. Like immediately, I wanted to try it all.
All right, I want to pick up on that theme coming forward. But once again, we're reminded these stories echo so familiarly across the board. This sense of I don't fit anywhere, something's wrong, drugs are introduced or alcohol early on, and that feeling is alleviated. It's the almost essence of why this disease is so scary and so potent. You're listening to Recovery Radio. We have more with our guest straight ahead. Please don't go away. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. Steve Martorano with you, along with Maggie Hunt, who's the director of Alumni Services Group at Retreat, Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. From time to time, Maggie brings in or has on the telephone one of the members of the alumni group to share with us their story of substance abuse and their road to recovery. Maggie, you've heard David Leese, who's on the phone with us now, and you were with him during some of these struggles, right? Because you were going through a similar situation.
Yeah. But I also think, too, you know, hearing his story and seeing where he came from and to where he is today, like, is such a miracle. And I know that a lot of staff who are at Retreat, who have seen him at other treatment centers, are so proud of him today that he's like staying sober and doing the right thing. So I'm just happy to hear, you know, him tell it in his own words, you know, because we saw it from an outsider's perspective. So now to hear, you know, how he felt about it is interesting to me.
David, you're 28 years old. We hear you talk about discovering marijuana at an early age, 12, 13, having an immediate affinity for it. You liked it. It filled something missing in you. That's a very, very common experience for millions of people who didn't wind up with a substance abuse problem. One of the things we find valuable in talking to folks who are now sober is how that happened for them. As you look back on your addiction, can you tell us about a couple of sort of stops along the way when you kept ratcheting this thing up? What followed marijuana, for instance?
I mean, like we pretty much had mentioned, you know, when I had smoked for the first time, I felt I wanted to experience everything else so early on. And at this point, my dad had also been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. And you'll understand why I'm tying this in. So, like, pretty much within a few weeks of smoking for the first time, like, I'm, you know, reaching out to people. I tried benzos for the first time shortly after, painkillers, you know, cocaine shortly after that. I mean, I remember within a week of, you know, trying cocaine, looking up how to, you know, cook it in a crack because I wanted the next high, and it was just like a constant chase for something greater, something to take me more outside of myself. And around this time, like I said, my dad had been diagnosed, and like I just remember feeling like, you know, all the progress I made in life and like my entire world had, you know, crashed down, and, you know, didn't know how to deal with it, and drugs seemed to be the only option. And he's in hospice at this point, and, you know, my dad never, you know, took drugs or anything, and he didn't even like how the painkillers he was prescribed made him feel. So a lot of them just sat and gathered dust, and, you know, not justifying it or whatever. You know, I used to, you know, take one here or there, and I loved how it made me feel, and, you know, it just, you know, snowballed. And, you know, as my addiction progressed, like, his disease progressed as well. And I can remember when he, you know, took his last breath, like I was there with him, and I was able to say goodbye. And I just remember being so numb that I just didn't, like, I wasn't able to cry, I wasn't able to have any emotions. And like, as soon as, you know, they came to, you know, remove his body, I just remember, like, the attic part of my head, you know, clicked in, and I took all the painkillers, you know, and just stashed them somewhere before they could flush them. And, you know, it just, it progressed. And at that point, it was like all bets were off, and I lost all sense of self-preservation. And like, I literally lived for the high. I lived to, like, and this is 14, 15 years old, you know, I'm not doing good in school. I'm, you know, not even mentally there when I'm there. I'm under the influence. And it got to the point between, you know, my family being torn apart from, you know, this illness, you know, that my dad had to, you know, my illness, it just, you know, tore the family up. And, you know, my mom and sister weren't able to grieve. You know, I just caused too much of a, you know, distraction, because then they're worried about, you know, me. And, you know, I found myself in my first treatment involuntarily, you know, at, you know, 15, but we'll touch on that later.
At 15. So let me interrupt for just a second, because your story is interesting in many regards, but particularly in this regard. Maggie, maybe you can comment. David, you were just primed. There was nothing gradual about your descent into this thing. I mean, from the your early, even if you go back to the adoption effect it may have had on you, and then Ritalin as a youngster, once you're introduced to a substance that's illicit and gets you high, you went off like a Roman candle, didn't you? There was no stopping it go. You were just flat out going for it, right?
Yep.
That's a little different than some of the stories I've heard. I mean, it's not all, not everybody's disease at the end sort of looks like it was a big rush, but David sounds a little more extreme. Am I wrong?
Yeah, no, I think that usually like it's a, you know, it's like a story of progression, and it usually takes like a little bit longer. But for Dave, I think it went pretty quickly.
Yeah, it sounds very, very intense. So 15, you are in your first treatment program against your will. We're going to pick up on the history of your treatment and what didn't work and why it didn't work and where you are right now, straight ahead. So everybody stick around. You're listening to Recovery Radio, and we will be right back. Welcome back to Recovery Radio. A reminder, the whole thing is sponsored by Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers. Listen, if you're looking for a facility, let me tell you, you could do no better than Retreat. They are justifiably proud of their reputation as leaders in the field of addiction treatment. And they have facilities here in our area in Lancaster County, and, of course, the latest facility, which is in West Palm in Florida. I give you their phone number as an informational tool if you have questions or comments about the treatment you're getting now or looking for treatment. Any questions, any comments you might have, about the disease of addiction and treatment that's available. They will answer your questions. They will. 855-859-8808. That's Retreat Premier Addiction Treatment Centers, 855-859-8808. Among the many things that make Retreat unique is their alumni program. We bring in members of that group periodically to tell you their story of substance abuse and their eventual sobriety, and we do that with the director of that group, Maggie Hunt. Maggie has a vested interest in our guest, David Leese. She shared some of his problems and some of his treatments as she gained sobriety, and we thank her for her efforts in that regard. David is on the phone with us telling us his story. So, David, the first time your substance abuse lands you in treatment, it's against your will and you're 15. That was a court-ordered kind of thing. Is that what the deal was?
Yes, it was through probation and my mom kind of conspiring together, trying to come up with the best option for trying to, you know, lead me towards, you know, recovery and wanting to be clean.
Was that first trip in a residential situation?
Yes, it was a juvenile facility in Quakertown. I'm not sure if it's even still around. I think it was called Renewal.
Yeah, we don't need the names of the specific places. Just tell us what your experience was as you go through this process.
All right, well, you know, I remember when I got in there, I just, you know, pretty much everybody was in there against their will, you know, whether it was probation or, you know, their parents gave them an ultimatum. And I just remember just a lot of war storying and talking about, you know, how we can't wait till we get out. And I mean, myself included, I just, you know, was pretty much trying to, you know, just say whatever the counselor or therapist, you know, wanted to hear, you know, especially in the family sessions, to try to convince my mom to, you know, let me come home so I could, you know, continue with what I wanted to do. And
which was get high.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I can remember within, you know, a few hours of getting out, you know, smoking weed and, you know, just my mom even gave me an ultimatum. She said, like, if you, like, at this point, I was also enrolled in a intensive outpatient, you know, following the inpatient treatment. And she gave me the ultimatum saying that if you have one high urine, you're going to be going away for a long time, like possibly till you're 18 years old. And like, it's not that I didn't believe her, but I just had no, like, I didn't care about repercussions. I thought I lived in the moment. I thought as far as like, I want what I want when I want it and I'll deal with whatever happens later. So like I said, I was smoking pot within, you know, a few hours and, you know, whatever else. And I remember maybe a couple weeks later, you know, getting a random at the IOP, and I remember actually trying to give them apple juice as urine, and like they caught on to it right away, called my mom, and, you know, my mom pretty much told me, like, look, like, you know, don't be expecting to, you know, live here much longer because, you know, you're going away. And there was that little grace period where I guess she was trying to figure out, you know, where to send me. And, you know, I just continue to use, you know. And, you know, the day came where I was placed in a residential treatment facility, and I wound up spending 11 months there.
Was that voluntary or involuntary?
This was all involuntary.
11 months.
When I was a juvenile.
Okay.
So.
All right. When was the first time? I don't want you to miss things you want to bring up. So certainly go ahead and talk about it. But when was the first time you got into a facility or treatment facility voluntarily?
I was 18 years old. I'd been partying all night, and I remember the sun was just coming up, and I just had a bunch of drugs in front of me. It's not like I ran out or I was, you know, whatever, and I just remember just feeling empty and, like, hollow inside, and, like, I just felt like, you know, even with the drugs, it was like it no longer gave me that relief, and I just felt miserable. And I called my mom up, and she was actually at church. It was a Sunday morning. And I, you know, told her, like, I have a problem and, like, I really want help this time, you know. And this was, like, my first time ever actually reaching out and saying that I want to stop. And, you know, that's when you know, she made some phone calls. I wound up meeting up with her. I, you know, threw the rest of my drugs in the Schuylkill River and, you know, got into, am I allowed to say the name of it or?
You got, sure. You mean the treatment facility?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Yeah, I wound up getting a bed at Malvern mm-hmm. Institute.
Sure.
And this is my first day at Malvern. You know, and I can remember actually trying. Like, I remember participating in the groups. And at this point, they had me in the detox section, you know, because I'd been drinking a lot. So they wanted to just monitor that. And I can remember as soon as, you know, I got upstairs, to the rehab, I had a couple roommates who weren't as serious about it. And long story short, and this says nothing against, you know, that facility, because this can happen anywhere. I wound up relapsing in rehab. And, you know, at that point, like, my whole focus, and it's crazy how I went from wanting it so bad to, you know, having an opportunity and picking up, because it just shows how powerful it is. Like, I had no intention. And the fact that when, you know, a opportunity presents itself and you're not strong enough at that point, you know, anything can happen. So that treatment pretty much, you know, I don't want to say went to waste, because I feel as though a seed had been planted. But, you know, from that point on, you know, it was pretty much in and out of treatment. And shortly after I got out of there, I broke my back in a car accident, and they put me on high doses of painkillers. And at that point, like, I picked up an opiate habit and I was hooked. Like, I put all the other drugs aside, and that was what I lived for. And that is how I thought I wanted to feel for the rest of my life. And, you know, for a while I was prescribed. So it was like, I almost felt like I had an unlimited supply. If I ran out, I would buy it on the street. And I guess around 19 at this point, because I was laid up for a while, I was like pretty much in the house, you know, recovering. Around 19, I, you know, got kicked off the painkillers. They cut me off, and, you know, I was buying them on the street for a while. And, you know, eventually somebody, you know, told me that there was, you know, a cheaper alternative. I wouldn't be spending nearly as much as I'm spending on the prescriptions. And, you know, hence I tried heroin for the first time.
At what point did you, Maggie, what point did you guys intersect in your treatment?
Well, at the same facility that he's talking about, I was at that same facility like four times in 9 months. So I'm not 100% sure exactly which stay it was, because they all pretty much run together. And David probably would say the same thing, because I think
it was in 2008, I believe.
Oh, okay, yeah. So at the same time, like, you know, we both were like in and out of treatment, and that is when we met for the first time.
So, you know, David, you said something interesting. The first time you voluntarily decided of your own, you know, free will that you needed to help, you called your mom that Sunday morning. It wasn't because you'd run out of money or desperation. You were just exhausted by the life you were leading, exhausted by it. And I want to know, each time you stumble when somebody's going through this, each time you relapse, I kind of view that now as it's regrettable, but it's not a failure in the ultimate sense, if you continue trying to get sober. Do you remember feeling that? Because you relapse your share of times, right?
Yeah.
So what was it that picks you up off the floor and tries again? Why do you do that?
I mean, at this point, the heroin, you know, just took me to a whole new level. It just, you know, emotionally and spiritually just, you know, ate away at my soul. And you know, like Maggie had mentioned, like, I went back to Malvern that second time, and that's when I was in there with her. And, you know, it's amazing just to, you know, see the growth in people, you know. And again, you know, I did my treatment. I think I stayed the whole time that time, but I was, you know, notorious for leaving against medical advice and I was notorious for, you know, sometimes I would just like jump the fence. I wouldn't even sign out. Like I would just leave my belongings. Like, I had no rational thinking. So I would just like, you know, even though I'm there voluntarily, it would almost be like I would feel like I had to escape, like, you know, physically and mentally. Sure. So I would just literally like wander off.
At what point did you get to retreat?
The first time I went to retreat was in 2011. It was shortly after a long run I had in Philadelphia where I'd been shot four times for getting into an altercation with a dealer. And I remember I had a broken arm and a broken shoulder.
Yeah,
like,
I remember that.
Whatever
remember
you
that.
Call that.
A sling.
Like a joint in your shoulder. And I just remember being beaten down. I you know, feeling as though, like, I didn't really know, like, where my life was headed. But due to the fact that, like, I was kind of limited from, you know, having a cast on and all that, the first time I went to retreat, I can't honestly say I had a strong desire. I just wanted a break. I was just beaten up so bad, and I wanted to have an opportunity to, you know, kind of just take a rest. And, you know, again, not having my head and my heart completely in it, you know, it, which is why, you know, over the past 10 years, I've been to 20 plus rehabs. Like, we'd be here all day if we talked about every rehab I went to, because I just never followed through. I would make the first step, but when it came to actually following up and taking suggestions and, you know, dealing with the feelings, because once you go to rehab, and anybody who's been to rehab will tell you this, like, when you get in there, that's when the, you know, once you get off detox and you're done with the whole medically induced like haze that you're in, and you feel better physically, that's when it's like the whole world comes crashing down on you, because everything you've put off and avoided and feelings that you don't even know, like, you're just bombarded from like every, you know, direction with different emotions, and for somebody who's not used to dealing with emotions, it's almost like overwhelming. Yeah. And instead of just sitting in it and dealing with it and letting, you know, the feelings happen, you know, I chose to run a lot because it would get too uncomfortable and like I wouldn't know what to do.
David Lease is our guest on the telephone. He is 1 year sober now, telling us about his history of substance abuse and in and out of treatment facilities. Something changed because, as I said, he's sober. We will continue with him straight ahead. This is Recovery Radio. We're back on Recovery Radio. We have been really grateful for Maggie Hunt to bring in the alumni people and have them speak so frankly about their struggles. I mean, and I know you're familiar with David, our guest on the phone's story. It is, I mean, these stories are never pleasant anyway. David's particularly a tough story. A lot of substance abuse beginning at a very early age, culminating in a heroin addiction and multiple trips in and out of rehab. So, David, thanks for your candor, first of all. Let me ask you now where we are right now, because people listening are going to go, please, 20 times in and out? What, are we kidding? Something's different. Do you think something's different? Tell us about where you are now and how you finally got, you know, to be sober.
All right. Well, long story short, where I'm at now, I wake up feeling hopeful, looking forward to whatever life may bring today. I don't wake up, you know, feeling as though I need to use a crutch to, you know, get through life or my day, and life shows up and I deal with it. I have a support group. I have an amazing, you know, girlfriend who's also in recovery, who works in treatment. I'm surrounded by people in recovery, you know, and it happens slowly, but, you know, it's to the point where today I, you know, I almost look at it like a death sentence, and today I can finally say, like, I'm happy to be alive, because for so long I just, like, flirted with death, and today when something happens or life shows up, instead of, you know, trying to bury it, I deal with it, and I welcome those feelings. And the way I got there this last time wasn't through conventional treatment. It was through turning myself in, because I wanted to die. I was on the run in I went to jail and I had no choice. I couldn't AMA, and I sat for 9 months, and you know, I was pretty much forced to deal with my feelings. And I got out and went up to a recovery house and followed, you know, all the suggestions, got involved with a home group, got a commitment, got a sponsor, started working the steps, and, you know, things were going well. And I will mention there was one slip. I had a relapse last November, which is what brings my sober date. Otherwise, it would be almost 2 years. I took one Suboxone, and as soon as I had taken it, I remember feeling like, what did I just do? Like, this, I felt miserable. I was like, it was the biggest mistake I ever made, but it was also the first time I only had just one and realized, you know what, like, yeah, this is not what I want to do with myself. And I called my sponsor, I got to a meeting, I got honest, and I realized, like, I almost feel as though I needed that last time, because it made me realize that I wasn't missing anything, and that nothing but misery and pain was, you know, at the doorstep if I went down that route. So I got back on the wagon, you know, and used that as a final experience to pretty much, you know, confirm that, you know, there is a hopeful life to live, and it is possible. And somebody like me, who's been to so many treatments and just did their own thing and didn't want to listen to anybody, like, and after enough time, it gets to a point where it's like, you don't wake up, like, and I'm not saying, like, anybody is capable of, you know, anybody can relapse. It doesn't matter how much time you have. Like, that's why you have to focus on the day. But, like, for me, it's gotten a lot easier. I've gotten to a point where it doesn't really cross my mind. Like, I can't tell you the last time, like, using has crossed my mind, but I will say this. Over the past month, my program has got a little lax. I haven't been to as many meetings. I've been working a lot, and I put myself in check, because even though I haven't had any warning signs or felt like picking up, I realized that I can't just write it off as, oh, I'm cured, just because I'm, you know, halfway through the steps and I don't think about using, because I'll never be cured. And that's why I got to a meeting, got my hand up, told myself, saying, look, I haven't been making as many meetings. And you know, I got redirected, and I could feel that relief. I didn't even know I had a weight on my shoulders until I walked out of there. I felt lighter, which is what tells me that, you know, being involved with an alumni, being involved with people that are clean and sober, getting involved with a fellowship, whatever fellowship it is, like, a program is the only way for somebody like me, you know, to maintain, you know, long-term sobriety. And I like to look at it like, I'm not going to be able to sit here and say, like, I'm never going to pick up again, because that's not realistic. But I can say for today, I'm going to do everything in my power to continue to maintain my program and be the best person I can be. And most importantly, reach out and try to help somebody else, because without helping somebody else, you can't pass on what was so freely given to you. You're not able to, and helping somebody else is a way to also get outside of yourself and stop worrying about self-centeredness and all the thoughts we had. If you reach out and help a newcomer, you don't, you could have 2 days and help somebody with a day. Like, all, it doesn't matter. Like, you can help anybody. And that's really what started, you know, the programs in the first place, you know, like, you know, one person helping another. And look at how it's in every country now. Yes, there's
it's everywhere,
you know,
now.
Meetings anywhere you go.
Hey David, thanks so much. We're out of time. Maggie, David's story should remind us all that, because it's a dark story, there are just no shortcuts here. You get to sobriety by the path you get to it by. So we wish David continued success. Thanks for being so honest with us and sharing the story. And thank you, Maggie, for introducing us to him.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
Take care, everybody. Enjoy the rest of the weekend. And look for us next week on Recovery Radio. Bye-bye.
This program is a paid commercial announcement and in no way represents the views of WPHT or its management.